This is The Source on KSTX, a product of the Texas Public Radio Newsroom. I'm David Martin Davies. By now, many of us are familiar with the long-running scandal in the U.S. military regarding sexual assault of service members. Many of the incidents have happened here at the San Antonio's Lackland Air Force Base with trainees, but it's just all across the military. A part of the problem has been commanders who were reluctant to investigate and prosecute the attackers. Now there's an effort in Washington, D.C., led by Senator Kristen Gillibrand, a Democrat from New York, to cut commanders out of that judicial process. Our two guests weigh in on opposite sides of the debate. David Schlieder, he is a Hardy professor of law at St. Mary's University. He was a JAG lawyer. And also Amos Giora, he is a co-director for the Center of Global Justice at the University of Utah. He was also a JAG lawyer for the Israeli Army and Navy. Welcome to The Source.
Thank you very much.
So let me ask you, Amos Giora, I mean, you are saying that this is the way to go, to take commanders out of the process, right?
In a nutshell, that'd be correct. Based on my experience and while serving, as you correctly said, as a JAG in the Israel Defense Forces, the IDF, the commander plays no role in the court-martial process, and I don't think that that in any way, shape, or form has harmed command influence, command unity, or any of the arguments that I've heard here in the United States.
So help me understand the problem. Why? Because that's not the U.S. tradition.
Right.
Our tradition is our commanders play a big role in the justice that happens with their military men and women. So to explain to me the level of the problem that we have right now, that we need to deviate from our military tradition to something new.
I mean, in terms of how one has to be careful here not to, you know, say that the Israeli system is a perfect fit on into the American system. There obviously are differences, but the fundamental, if you will, philosophical, existential question is the commander's mission compromised if he is not involved in the court-martial process? The Israeli experience unequivocally says that the commander's mission in no way is compromised or harmed if he's not involved in the court-martial system.
All right, let's get over to David Schlieder. He is your professor at St. Mary's University, law professor, and you are arguing that this would not be good for the military. Can you kind of tell us more about that?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I recently completed a major law review article on this very subject, just coincidentally, in which I trace the history of the military justice system, which finds its roots in the British Articles of War. And unlike some of the other countries, such as Israel, Great Britain, we have always placed a great confidence and trust in the military commander to take care of the good order and discipline. And one of those tools is the military justice system. Part of the problem of shifting prosecution over to a specialized military justice prosecutor, as has been recommended in the reforms, or even to the civilian community, is that it's in many ways unworkable simply because of the vast number of individuals on active duty. It's well over 2 million people, literally on a worldwide basis. And if you can imagine that while we here in San Antonio could see it be very practical, perhaps even efficient, to transfer prosecution of offenses from Lackland Air Force Base or Fort Sam Houston to the district attorney's office or to a centralized military prosecutor here in San Antonio, if you are at a smaller installation or if you're overseas, it creates tremendous problems of coordinating and making sure that that court martials are carried out. And so my conclusion in the research was that the primary purpose and function of military justice from the beginning has been a discipline function, and that sometimes is hard for the civilian community to understand, because we in the civilian community are more familiar with working for CEOs or with bosses who can fire us if we don't do our job. But in the military, it's a completely different system where the commander is viewed as the person in charge, both in peacetime and in wartime.
Our phone number, if you want to join the conversation, we invite you to join the conversation, 614-8980, 614-8980. You could also email your questions and comments to me at thesource@tpr.org. So, David Schlieder, We're seeing, though, a breakdown in the system. We've seen over the past few years people, of women mainly, afraid to report being sexually assaulted because they felt like their commanders would not protect their interest.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I understand that, and those actions are indefensible. I think it's important, however, to understand that the military has never been free of problems with personnel or scandals. And as I've said to a number of people who have asked me this very question, that one of the things about the military is that it is able to fix problems, perhaps quicker and more efficiently than in the civilian community. It takes a command from the top, a word from the top, and everything that I've heard so far is that the Pentagon has moved to resolve a number of these issues. I know that in the Army for a number of years, I guess for the last 5 or 6 years, they have appointed victims advocates, not just in sexual assault cases, but any victim who is the victim of an assault, whether it be sexual or otherwise. And more recently, I know that in the Army, and I think the other services are moving in the same direction, they're actually going to be entitled to the assistance of counsel to address this very problem. So I don't accept quickly the premise that the whole system is broken. It clearly didn't work for these individuals, but until you are able to go through all of these cases to analyze what in fact is the case, it's not new, for example, that victims are reluctant to come forward, and that's true not just for sexual assault victims, for any victim, civilian and military. I think if you talk to civilian prosecutors, you'll often find that sexual assault victims in the civilian community are just as reluctant to come forward because they're afraid that a spouse or a loved one or a significant other will find out that they've been sexually assaulted, or that they're afraid they're going to be subject to ridicule. So I don't see the military as having necessarily a major problem that can't be fixed. My point is that there are things that need to be remedied, but I don't find and I don't trust the proposed amendment because I think in the long run, they'll create a long list of unintended consequences.
Amos Giora, can you address that? He's saying that there is a fix now and it works. It's the military self-correcting.
I understand David's point, and I have a great respect for that argument, but I think that the more important point here than, you know, command and commanders and command mission and those other terms that we all love to use, there's another piece to the puzzle, which maybe, frankly, is more important, and that is the victim, whether it's a male or female who's been the victim, for instance, of a sexual assault. And the question is, what's going to be the best judicial paradigm that affords that individual the most equitable, fair system where they feel that the assailant is going to be on equal footing with them,
okay,
and not have some kind of a heads up, hands up.
Okay, we're going to continue. We've got to take a quick break, a minute break, but then we'll be right back. We're going to continue this conversation. We're also going to take our calls. Our phone line is 614-8980, 614-8980. We're talking about whether or not commanders should be taken out of the process when there is a sexual assault or a murder that happens within their ranks. This is The Source on KSTX, and we will be right back. Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. Right now in Washington, D.C., Senator Kristen Gillibrand, a Democrat from New York, is talking about passing a law that would allow investigations and prosecutions into sexual assault in the military to be done by an outside prosecutor, be taking it out of the hands of the commanders involved in that base or that post. And she's getting support from even Texas Senator Ted Cruz and Rand Paul, two conservative Republicans. So this is something that's crossing party lines. It's gaining traction in Washington, D.C. And so we're talking about that right now. What impact would this have with our troops and with our military and military readiness and discipline? Talking about that, we've got David Schlieder. He's a Hardy Professor of Law at St. Mary's University, a former JAG lawyer for almost 10 years. And Amos Giora, he is a co-director for the Center of Global Justice at the University of Utah, and he was a JAG lawyer for the Israeli Army and Navy, where they do things differently. But okay, so all that being said, let's get to the calls because we're getting a lot of calls. The number is 614-8980. Let's get Brady on the phone. Brady, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to weigh in. I'm kind of in the middle of your two guests there. As a military officer, I mean, there's a tool that we have to enforce discipline called the Article 15 as part of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and that allows commanders to implement discipline without the need for a court-martial. It's completely outside the courts. But then at the same time, you know, if something goes to a court-martial, then I don't think that the commander should have any dealing with that, especially like with the incident in the Air Force where the general stepped in after a guy was convicted by a jury and said, "Oh yeah, we're not actually going to enforce that." You know, that's ridiculous to me. But the Article 15 is an essential tool to enforcing discipline in the UCMJ.
So Brady, you are now an active duty member of the Armed Forces.
That's correct.
So how would you see this impacting if the prosecution and investigation was taken out of the hands of the commander, impacting discipline in the ranks?
Well, it would just kind of throw the whole thing into disarray. I don't know. Well, in the immediate effect, it would be that the troops wouldn't have to. I don't want to say fear the commander, but you know, when they know that the commander has UCMJ authority to punish them. You know, without it doesn't even have to go outside company level at times. That's a very small, very very low level punishment. You know, if they don't have to worry about that, then basically it would just jam up the entire system. And you know, for any minor infraction, it would basically have to go to court martial.
Okay, Brady, thank you so much for calling in. We appreciate your expertise and your service, sir. Thank you. So, David Schlieder, you're talking to Brady. He's saying, many things there. What's your reaction?
Yes, I think he hit on a really good point. One of the unintended consequences that I mentioned before the break addresses the Article 15. The Article 15 has been considered by Congress in the past and the courts an indispensable disciplinary tool for the commander. As I understand the legislation and the comments supporting it, if the 06 or the full colonel who would now be the military prosecutor decides not to prosecute a particular case, they would throw it back to the local commander with the idea that they could give an Article 15. But the service member can actually put a checkmate on that because an Article 15 is a consent proceeding unless you're assigned to a vessel, such as in the Navy. So if a commander decides to offer an Article 15, the service member, especially in the Army, can always say, "I've declined to take the Article 15," in which case the commander goes to a court-martial. But if the commander's been taken out of the court-martial chain of command and the accused says, "I don't want the Article 15," then the commander's options are very limited, and he may have to take administrative action or simply not take any action at all. That's one of those unintended consequences. That doesn't mean it can't be fixed, but it is a problem. One thing I can add, unless you've got a caller and want to move on, the whole thing that strikes me about the underlying premise of this proposed legislation is it's going to increase more prosecutions. It sounds from listening to the proponents of this that they want more prosecutions. They don't trust the command to do it, which means that there are going to be a number of service members who may be unjustly tried or charged or in this rush to judgment. And so I think we have to be very careful about changing any system that's going to tip the delicate balance away from what it currently exists, that is the rights of the accused, which must be protected under the Constitution, and prosecutorial discretion, which doesn't rest only in the commander. The commander has the say, but it's the lawyers who actually draft up the charges, draft up all the legal documents, and give the advice to the commander. Commanders will prosecute a case.
All right, well, let's get Amos back in on this. We've mentioned many things that he probably wants to address. So one of them is that if commanders don't have the ability to prosecute their people in their ranks and he loses some of his authority, and also, you know, David Schlieder's bringing up the fact that, you know, if we go with this, then we may see a rise of false accusations of sexual assault for whatever reason. So, Amos, what do you think about that?
Right. I think that, based on the experience of the Israel Defense Forces, the fact that the commanders are not involved in the court-martial process, I don't see in any way how that impacts their influence on their unit. Frankly, that's an argument that I've heard before. I've heard repeatedly that I just don't see it. I think it's an argument that's put out there literally by rote, by template, that I don't think is particularly convincing. If if the JAG, and don't forget that in the IDF, unlike in the American military, the JAG is not in the chain of command of the commander. He's totally outside the chain of that command. He's under the command of the JAG, of the Judge Advocate General himself. He's absolutely independent in terms of determining whether or not there is justification for prosecution or to close the case or to move it over for a disciplinary hearing. If it's a disciplinary hearing, then that is turned over to the commander. The fact that in the IDF, the JAG is totally, wholly, thoroughly independent of the commander, I don't think is a negative from the commander's perspective. I don't think it's a negative from the perspective of the victim, and I don't think it's a negative from the perspective of the assailant.
Okay, so you don't buy that. You don't think that's
not at all.
Okay, and what about his point about this would bring a rise to false accusations of sexual assault?
So I don't know in terms of UCMJ, but in Israel, in the IDF, if you make a false claim against somebody, who, let's say a false accusation with respect to a rape, for instance, the person who's making the false claim, can be prosecuted. And I can count on one hand the number of times that I've dealt, when I was a JAG, that I dealt with false claims. I think that's also an argument that's being used that is not really premised on, as far as I can tell, on sound empirical research.
Okay, I'm going to get back to the callers. We got a lot of calls. Let's get Chris on the line. Chris, welcome to The Source.
How you doing?
Doing good, sir. Go right ahead.
Well, I did 24 years active duty in the Navy, and I think taking that authority out of the commander's hand as far as the Article 15 is NJP is a bad idea. One, I think it undermines the authority of the commanding officer with his personnel, and two, I do agree. I think it would lead to an increase in accusations and cases. I think that's what some people would like to see. I just don't think it's a good idea. And the fact of the matter is most cases are handled with NJP, not by courts-martial. In fact, I don't know if people knew it, but in the Navy, if you're on sea duty on a ship, you don't have the right to a court-martial. It can be refused by the commanding officer. You can request one, but he can refuse it.
Right, and this would disrupt that, I imagine.
Absolutely, it would.
All right.
Absolutely, it would.
Chris, thank you so much for your call. Appreciate it, and thank you for your service. And so David Schlieder, he's waning with you. He's been in the Navy for 24 years.
Yes, and I agree with him. And I guess I should add, I have personal experience. I was a prosecutor at Fort Belvoir a number of years ago, so I had to deal with these issues. And I think one of the elements that's missing from the amendments is the fact that the JAG, the prosecutor, is a staff officer for the commander. Much as there are doctors and supply specialists who work for the commander, who gets advice from all of them to decide how to best manage the command. And it's really important to understand that when they're in garrison or they're here at home, the lawyer becomes a confidant for the commander, can give them legal advice on a variety of issues, including military justice. And then when that command is deployed to a combat zone, the JAG goes along and continues to give legal advice. And so both of them working together manage the system very effectively. The proposed amendments would completely disrupt that. And the idea is it really demonstrates a hostility toward the command structure. And as I said, I think they think they're going to be able to solve some of these problems by putting it in the hands of another office, which in effect will create another level of bureaucracy. As best I can understand, they'll probably have in the United States six regional prosecutors' offices of high-ranking JAGs, but they're going to require staff officers.
Now, let me get to this point.
The decision will be made at a remote location.
So let me get to this point. It seemed like the officers, commanders, were reluctant to investigate and prosecute these allegations of sexual assault because they thought it was going to reflect poorly on their command, and then it would hurt them. And so was that the case at Amos?
I'm not sure I understood your question.
That the commanders were reluctant to prosecute and investigate these allegations of rape because it was going to reflect poorly on their own command.
Yeah, I don't know, because in the IDF, the commander is not a player in the decision-making process at all. If there's a rape, God forbid, it comes to the attention of the military police that investigates. They turn it over to the Judge Advocate General, and the Judge Advocate General reviews the evidence. Prosecutorial discretion makes a determination yes or no to prosecute. When I was a JAG, I informed the commander that I had decided to prosecute one of his subordinates, and my responsibility was to inform him collegially, but I in a collegial context. But he had no say whatsoever in the decision-making process.
Okay.
And I am hard pressed to understand how that impacts negatively command influence or the successful implementation of the command mission. I understand that there are obviously differences between the numbers in the United States and numbers in the IDF, but the question is a larger question than mere logistics. And then I just want to quote the former Chief Justice of the Israeli Supreme Court, Aaron Barak, who said something which is absolutely applicable to this conversation. Barak said that the logistical burdens of the state need not be borne by the individual, which goes back to what I suggested at the beginning, that we also need to ask ourselves, what's the best interest of the person who has been who's the victim of a crime, whatever crime it is. We're all focusing here on sexual assault, so this goes far beyond sexual assault in terms of the pending legislation.
So, David Schlieder, what are we seeing now that shows us that the military is figuring this out and that this legislation is not necessary?
I understand that they're forming a committee to study the system of military justice in a broader fashion. I don't have the specifics, but I understand in talking with colleagues in Washington that the Secretary of Defense has decided that in light of all of this discussion that it would be good to look at the broader question of military justice. I mentioned earlier the move to provide lawyers for victims, which can create another level of adversarial process. I'm assuming that this the victim's lawyer would actually work with the prosecutor to ensure, just as Amos said, that justice is done for the victim, which
right.
has been a growing concern.
What Americans want to know is that when we send our young boys and our women into the military, that they will be treated fairly and that they won't be caught in a bad system. And we need that fixed, right?
Absolutely.
All right, I need to thank both of you guys. David Schlieder, he is a Hardy Professor of Law at St. Mary's University, a former JAG lawyer, and Amos Girora, he is a co-director for the Center of Global Justice at the University of Utah and was a JAG lawyer for the Israeli Army. This is The Source on KSTX.